Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 20th. The first order of business is approval of the minutes from March 14th. Representative Mahoney moves approval of the minutes dated March 14th. Any corrections, changes, or additions or subtractions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we're going to start off with House File 3763, Representative Lehman. Representative Lehman moves House File 3763 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm here to present House File 3763, and with me is the Commissioner of the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation, Mark Phillips. And we're here to present what I think is a pretty simple, straightforward bill. And it's really not making any big change. It's clarifying use of funds. And this bill impacts the statutes around the Douglas J. Johnson Trust Fund. And for those of you who have been around a while, you have probably heard many times about taconite production taxes and the Douglas Johnson Fund. And you've heard people talk about the fact that they're a little bit different than other taxes and that they're paid basically in lieu of local property tax by the taconite companies. And the DJJ Trust is held in trust by the state for that purpose. And my bill just simply adds a line to the section regarding use of funds that says, money devoted to the trust fund under this section shall not be expended, appropriated, or transferred from the trust fund for any purpose except as provided in this section. And with that, if Mark has additional comments, I'd invite him to do that.
Before we do that, Representative Lehman, is the A1 amendment yours? Is it an author's amendment?
Well, I have no amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the A1 amendment's not being offered? Okay. So, welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Phillips. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation. I don't have a lot to add. I think it was 2 years ago, there was a move to move money from this trust fund to a separate trust that the agency was going to set up outside of state government. Very controversial. So we were asked by many people at the legislature if we could look at a different method of accomplishing a similar outcome. So with a lot of advice, we came up with this language as a way to protect our trust fund from being appropriated for other uses. So not much to add. Be straightforward.
Let's go. Representative Lehman, do you have any other invited testifiers?
No, this is my testifier, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments. Questions and comments from members of the committee. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lehman. Thank you for bringing this forward. We aren't going to argue about this one. It's a good bill.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious if money has been transferred from this fund on any previous occasions, and if so, if it's been repaid.
To either Mr. Phillips or to Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware, there have been attempts. I don't think it ever made into law.
Okay.
Representative Lehman?
Well, when I was commissioner, yes. I served in Mark's role in the past. When there was a state deficit, and a significant deficit, and all funds were being looked at, this fund was tapped in addition to other funds to help resolve that deficit. And then after a period of time was repaid. Yes.
And so on the repayment schedule, Representative Mahoney.
Oh, go right ahead, Mr. Chair, with the repayment schedule. I'm just, Mr. Chair and Representative and Commissioner Phillips, is this the Prevent Tim Pollutant bill?
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Lehman, any closing comments?
No, I just think it's a straight. It's just really articulating what we believe to be law, that the funds are to be used as stated in law, and it's just emphasizing that with this language. Thank you.
With that, Representative Lehman renews her motion to have House File 3763 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Representative Wiginius, are you ready to go?
I am, but I do want to turn off my phone. I did that.
And Representative Wiginius moves that House File 3760 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. And Representative Wiginius, is the A2 amendment your amendment?
It is my amendment, and I would like to put it on.
Representative Wiginius moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All say nay. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Wiginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This is a bill to put solar on the to provide electricity for schools in the XL service area. I want you to know that I also have a bonding bill where I make provisions for schools that are not in the XL service area. So we can talk about that too. It's just that the bills come to different committees. There are two reasons for me to bring this bill to you. One is we can support schools in many ways besides just giving them general fund money. And the other reason I bring this to you is that schools that have solar have found it to be super helpful engaging students in math and science. So to give you an idea of what it costs to do to provide electricity in a school, I asked one of my school districts, which is Minneapolis, to give me the cost of electricity in a high school, a middle school, and an elementary school. And the numbers, I think, have surprised all of us. We chose Southwest High School, and the electricity bill for 2017 was $274,000+. For Justice Page Middle School, it was $146,000, and for Hale K-3, it was $63,000. And I will point out to you that Hale School is super efficient. It was insulated for sound, which means it's also insulated for energy. But the interesting thing, if I could have a page hand this out, is I got the number of school districts the number of school buildings in the state, and we divided up, I got it from House Research, and so we took those numbers.
That's cool.
And I multiplied the number, the cost of Hale School, which I expect is pretty low compared to a lot, by the number of elementary schools in the state. And then we did the same thing for middle schools and for high schools. There were two that were kind of different. There were some 10K to 12 schools, and I used the elementary school number there, which means that I took probably the low ball number. And then there are 220K, 7 to 12 schools, and I use the high school cost in the multiplication there. And so you can see the total cost that we expend in Minnesota, a rough estimate. I am not going to say, I don't think anybody has the real number, but this is a rough estimate of what we spend in Minnesota. And when you're talking about $220 million, that's real money. We expect that the XL service area is about half of that in expenditures, and the rest of the state is the other half. That is only rough, and that is my estimate.
because I don't think there are the numbers that we could give you any more solid than that. So I've given you the cost of electricity in schools, and I just want to tell you about there are two school systems in Minnesota that have talked to publicly about how they are using solar systems to engage students in math and science. One is an example of Chisago Lakes Middle School. They called it Project Independence, and they put up 44 solar panels, and that was enough electricity for their media center. And that was a total cost of $73,000. They estimate that the Chisago Lakes School District will save $433,000 in energy costs over the 30-year lifespan. In terms of engaging students, what they say is all the students have electric devices. They carry them around in their hand all the time. And you can ask, where does the electricity come from? How does it work? So this is a kind of a student engagement. In that school, in the Chisago Lakes Middle School, they have a computer in the lobby that shows just how the electricity is being generated as it is being generated, which would be a good idea for all schools. Another example I'm going to give you is the Mounds View School District. They expect to save $1 million on utility bills in the next 25 years. They are super enthusiastic about how solar gives their students real-world learning.
Yeah, Representative McGinnis, can you define for the committee the difference between enthusiastic and super enthusiastic? What are the metrics we use to evaluate that, or is that?
Well, and here I will give you. I'm going to give you a quote. Now, this is a from Mike Cartwright. This is the Mounds View, and he is a physics teacher. And I don't understand what he said, but this is how he tried to engage his students. He said, and this is a report from NPR. Look at solar through the course of the day and see how that peaks and see if there's any correlation at all with cosmic ray collection data.
That's super enthusiastic, you're right. That is, absolutely.
So with that, the bill is pretty simple because it is a grants program. It is using what we used to call the RDF fund. I think it's now the energy fund. It is limited to school districts within the Xcel service area, though I do have a bill for outstate Minnesota. And we've put in the amendment that if it's cost effective or more cost effective, a school may use a solar lease or solar power purchase agreement. So that's basically the bill. I know there's some folks who would like to talk about the bill, so would you like them to come up?
Please. If you have an invited testifier you wish to start with, go ahead and say their name or just come on down. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to correct the author, it is not outstate, it is greater Minnesota. You should sit on the Ag Committee and say outstate and see what happens.
No, aren't we sensitive on the committee today? All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, my name is David Schaefer. I'm with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We're a 501c6 nonprofit trade group. We represent about 100 different solar companies, solar developers, solar installers, and other solar aficionados. So the message I want to bring here today is that solar on schools is wonderful. It is really great for both the solar community, the taxpayers, and the schools itself. So I'll go into that. First of all, the schools are flat, which works pretty well for solar. They tend to have very high energy use, so the solar arrays can cut down into that energy use and save the schools a lot of money. They tend to be unshaded areas, and ultimately the number one thing that's great about solar on schools is that the payback is about 5 years or less. And so if you're looking at a school that's going to be there indefinitely, you can see this payback period get I guess, multiplied by about 5 different times because these solar arrays are typically warrantied for a period of 25 years. Now, they often go up longer than the warranty period, but the 25 years ensures that you're going to see a significant savings over a significant period of time. So this money is great for the schools because it can be repurposed to pay for books, it can help pay for teachers, it can pay for anything that the schools needs, and that helps trickle down to the taxpayers who ultimately get to save money because they no longer have to use their property taxes to pay for these things at the school, including those books, the teacher salaries, or the energy itself. So that's sort of the trifecta there, the benefits that the school, the taxpayer, and the solar community sees. But the students really benefit from this as well. We have different solar installers that actually create solar curriculum. It's STEM-based, and it's all the way from K through 12. You'll see students and classes go up on the roofs and see the solar firsthand. Then they might take a physics test on how it works. So it's really a great educational opportunity, and the students that go into it have a great opportunity to learn about science, engineering, and they can use it as a great career exploration opportunity. So they might one day decide to be a physicist because of what they saw up on the roof, or maybe they'll decide to be a solar installer as well. So in my opinion, solar on schools is smart solar. It's solar done right. Really, every party wins, students grow, and it's just great for Minnesota in general. So if there's no questions, I'd be happy to conclude.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Eugenius, do you have any other invited testifiers?
There was somebody else who signed up.
Okay.
I didn't.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello. My name is Eric Possen, and I'm with IPS Solar. We are a local solar development company and installation company based out of Roseville, Minnesota. Thank you, Chair and members, for hearing my testimony today. We have quite a bit of experience with solar on schools, and to date, we've done over 48 projects on various schools in and around Minnesota. In the packet that was handed out or is being handed out currently, there's a little bit of information about why we believe the secondary benefits, aside from just energy savings, is probably the more important piece of the puzzle. We do a lot of training with school districts and educators about how to incorporate learning opportunities and specifically STEM learning opportunities into the classroom. Some of the photos on the page titled Sunrise Solar Program showcases some of our work with educators, where we host quarterly training for teachers to understand how to use the data acquisition systems that are associated with solar to provide math and engineering and science learning opportunities for kids. Representative Eugenius mentioned that we, both two school districts, Chisago Lake School District and Mounds View School District, as beneficiaries of solar on schools, these are our projects. And Mike Cartwright is not only a physics teacher there, but also a residential client of ours. And we have seen the engagement of students and faculty at both of those districts was surprisingly well received. And I think that in the context of Minnesota program going away, that was the funding program that allowed for most of those projects to move forward. And without that program now, we would really love to see an alternative funding mechanism such as this proposed bill that would allow us to bring solar to more educational facilities around XL territory. We would also support language in the bill for a solar lease, and that would further allow more solar to be provided on the schools, and a potential amendment to provide that any dollars that be spent on this program include STEM learning as a piece of that potential project. And so I'd encourage, we're in full support of this bill, and would encourage, I guess, any questions if there are any.
Thank you. Representative McGinnis, do you have any other invited testifiers? This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments. Questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This program sounds very good. I have to ask on your handout to the testifiers here, it says no upfront cost in most cases, and you talked about a five-year payback to the program. Why do we need state grants to make this work then? It just sounds like it's can fly on its own.
Great question. So no upfront cost was in reference to the former Made in Minnesota program, which did allow for funding where we could offer a no upfront cost proposal to school districts. And obviously that type of offer was very attractive for districts. We are no longer able to do that in lieu of there no longer being a Made in Minnesota program.
Representative Anderson. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, how did you arrive, Representative Wagenius, at the $16 million figure?
Well, I took that out.
Representative Wagenius.
That is out, and it's a blank right now.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see the
amendment. And I will tell members that if I had magic wand just read, I would say that the bonding bill that I have that has been heard in education finance, that it's $4 million. I had split that evenly between Representative Mahoney is going to contradict me here, so I've got to be very careful. Between schools in your district and schools in mine, and schools like yours and schools like mine, I think that bonding is more appropriate for non-Excel areas, but in that case, the district, since the way its bonding is structured, the school district would need to own the solar cells. With this money, it's more flexible, and we could use leases. So if we had $4 million here and $4 million there, we would make great strides in reducing the electricity costs for Minnesota schools.
Ms. Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, in the bill, I'm looking for, I mean, if you're going to put up any type of distributed generation system or renewable system that's not currently on the grid, you're going to have some sort of an agreement with the work provider. In this case, it's Xcel. What are the details in working those agreements out?
Representative Wagenius, or is there someone from Xcel?
I think Xcel could come and talk about that. I certainly did tell them about the bill. So if they would like to come and chat with you, I think that would be good.
Are any of the highly paid corporate executives from Xcel present to testify on this? No, I said highly paid, not you two. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. I'm sorry. We're not on TV today, so I feel like I can play. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Mr. Chair, Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Maybe I'll ask someone to repeat the question to make sure I got it right.
Representative Fabian, if you could
thank
repeat
you,
the question.
Mr. Chair, I will. I'm just curious to know how you're going to arrive at some sort of an agreement, because obviously if you've got somebody else producing electricity on your system, you've got to be able to make sure that all the switches and dials and meters and so forth are there and you have some sort of an agreement.
Mr. Evans.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. So, you know, anyone in our service territory is able to put rooftop solar on their own property to serve their own property. We have, you know, already funded out of the Renewable Development Fund our solar rewards program, which was created in, I think, about 2013, which allows customers to get subsidized rooftop solar on their homes and businesses. So how this would work, I mean, it's essentially a question of how the money is transferred to the customer, but we would treat that customer like any other customer that came to us, whether they were subsidized or doing it on their own or however else. So, you know, we have a rooftop solar tariff that, you know, runs through the Public Utilities Commission, and this, I don't think these customers would be treated any differently than any other customers. It's just a question of where they're getting the money to do it.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I'm missing it in here, Representative Lagunas, I apologize, but is there a cap on how big these systems can be? I thought it went someplace 300.
Representative Lagunas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not meant for school districts to earn money. This is meant for school districts to have enough solar for their own building. But there is a cap in there, too. But that's basically it. This is not about earning money for the district.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then last question, I think. You mentioned school districts here just now in your testimony. Then I also see on page 1.13, or special school district, are you including, excluding charter schools, private schools? Who's eligible for this program? The school district obviously is a public school, but beyond that, who's eligible?
Representative Lagunas.
I'm going to have to check on that, but I assume charters would be, if they get public funding, they would be eligible.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Damian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just for clarification, private schools.
Representative Lagunas.
I don't have that in here. I have no objection to it. I mean, this is a discussion for this committee to have, and I have no objection to that.
And the last one on line 1.16, and maybe this is for the solar person who was there, but it says at the end, flat plate or excavated tube with a fixed orientation. Does that mean it can't move with the sun? Or Mr. Evans maybe can answer that?
Well, I didn't write the bill, but that's what I would assume meant a fixed system. Well, but maybe you'd want to ask the installers. They might have
if the installers want to come up, I'll take a shot at it. I think it's because solar thermal systems are fixed, but I could be wrong. But go ahead.
Yeah, so I would say that its purpose is just to make it set like that, and so it collects the sun's. There's no tracking systems. I think that's our notice.
Representative Fabian.
I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative McQuaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Virginius, I just wanted to tell you that I'm excited about your bill, and I spend Fridays in classrooms in my district, and I've had a number of students ask me why they don't have solar at their school, and so I was able to tell them about this bill, and they're really excited, so thank you for bringing it.
She's excited, but not super excited. Representative Virginius. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Virginius, is this identified just for one installer, or can other companies compete to put these on?
Representative Lagunas.
It's open.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lagunas, I was just looking at this little handout, and on here it shows off-site solar gardens, which is different than the solar rewards program. So can you tell me just a little bit, and maybe if Rick Evans could come back from Xcel Energy, I just have a quick question about the solar gardens program and how much it costs and things like that. So are you intending to include the solar gardens program in this as well? I guess that's the first question.
Representative Lagunas.
Well, I didn't hand that out and I didn't see it beforehand. There is a definition in here on line 2.10. It says it may be used to fund solar energy system placed on, adjacent to, or in proximity to the school district building using the electricity generated. So that's what the proposed statute says.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm still confused. Are you utilizing the solar rewards program or the,
no,
the solar gardens program?
No.
Representative Lagunas.
The answer is no.
And so Representative O'Neill, as I read this, the line 6. That's not line 10, though. Anyway, Representative O'Neill.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just trying to understand the handout because I talked about here it says the Solar Gardens Program, which is why I was asking Rick Evans if he would come back down because that's an incredibly expensive way to produce electricity. $140 a megawatt, I believe, is the number that we're paying for the solar gardens. I just wanted him to confirm that, so how much we're paying, $140 a megawatt, if we are in fact going to be using solar gardens for this, and then who's actually subsidizing that across the Xcel Energy territory.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, you're right. The solar gardens are one of the more expensive ways to produce energy. I haven't seen our latest numbers. I know last year we were talking about $140 a megawatt hour. I can't tell you if that's still valid. I will say that, you know, rooftop solar is not tremendously cheaper than that. I mean, both rooftop and solar gardens are expensive ways to produce electric energy. They help the customer who gets it and would help the school districts and, in this case, have the added benefit of the educational value. But, you know, if you were just out to make the cheapest solar energy that you could, you wouldn't do it this way. But that's not been the, you know, the direct. I mean, our solar rewards program is a rooftop solar program, and our solar gardens program is, you know, is a program that we have as well. I will say I do, Representative Virginia's reading her bill, I do think there'll be difficulty in putting solar installations on property that does not belong to the school. So
I didn't have that.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what, you know, we'll have to take another look at that, but it's got to be on the premises of the building that is being served by the energy. That's just kind of a requirement of the program.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
So, could we get just clarification from nonpartisan research if the solar rewards could be used and solar gardens could be used, or is this completely separate from those two?
Mr. Eloff, did you want to answer that now, or do you want to send a memo out later? It's up to you. Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I'm looking at lines 212 and 213, which says the school district receiving a rebate or other financial incentive for a solar energy system under section 116C.7792 is not eligible to receive a grant under this section. That's solar rewards. So this cannot be used in conjunction with solar rewards. I'm also looking at line 2.8, where it says that the grant must be used to fund a solar energy system whose capacity matches the electric load of the school district building, which leads me to believe it can't be greater than that, which it would need to be in order to be part of a community solar program.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? The testifier.
Yes. This is to Representative O'Neill. Those two handouts were marketing material on our behalf, and so that did represent kind of a broader conversation, solar and schools, which we also do community solar, but that's not at all specific to this bill. It's just a piece of marketing material that we currently have.
So the testifier, if we were to pass this at the end of session in May, would there be enough time for you to get out into the field this year, or would you need to kind of go through the marketing stuff and start construction?
We have a lot of school districts that have come to us after seeing kind of the success of other districts that have implemented solar and are excited about this potential bill. And I would think that by the end of the year, there would definitely be panels on the roofs of at least, you know, a handful of districts.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that begs me to ask the question, if other school districts have been doing this, what program are they using? I mean, are they being subsidized by somebody else, or is this just something that they're committed to in their own community and they're doing this without some form of state subsidy?
Testify if you have an example.
Yes. So the Mountain View School District, at the end of this year, will have about 12 of their school buildings that have solar on them. All of them were subsidized by the Made in Minnesota program, and that's been the vast majority of those 48 schools that I've mentioned that we've done projects with have been funded in part by the Made in Minnesota program, which is no longer available.
Representative Fabian.
One quick follow-up. Mr. Chair, what was the percentage of subsidy that they got from the Made in Minnesota solar program?
I want to say it was exceeding or up to 60% or something in that range of the project cost.
Yep. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Wiggins, any closing comments?
No, thank you all for considering this. I hope you again look at my handout that talked about the electric cost to schools.
With that, Representative McGinnis moves that House File 3760 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to the testifiers. Representative O'Neill.
Yeah.
Representative O'Neill moves that House File 3232 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative O'Neill, there's an amendment in our packet. Is the A1 amendment your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And Representative O'Neill moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form that you would like. Is there any comments, questions on that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative O'Neill, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill would modify the Xcel Energy Solar Rewards Program and make it a little bit more easier to use by those that are needed to use it. And it would increase from 20 kW to 40 kW a project that would be eligible for the program. And that's essentially what it does. There's a few other components, and to those, I'll turn to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Reid LeBeau, and I'm here on behalf of Ideal Energies. And we want to thank Representative O'Neill for bringing this bill. Really what this is corresponding policy language that we need due to the change that was made in the supplemental budget bill at the end of last year. You just had a discussion about the former Made in Minnesota program. When money was taken at the elimination of Made in Minnesota and put into solar rewards, those two programs had a different level of projects. Made in Minnesota was for projects up to 40 kilowatts, and solar rewards was just for projects to 20 kilowatts. And so this language is needed just to make sure that the intended beneficiaries of that money, so that the law follows those beneficiaries. That's really all this bill does.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the member the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments. Questions from members of the committee? Representative O'Neill, any closing comments?
Just thank you for your support to move it to the next committee.
Representative O'Neill moves that House File 3232 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. You're on your way to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to get Andrew for me?
All right, Representative Garofalo, would you like to move your bill to lay over for possible inclusion?
Madam Chair, I'll move that House File 3002 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a simple bill. You will look at on page 3 of the bill, lines 3.15 to 3.16. It deletes the statutory reference to unserved areas. That's because, effective early of last year, there are no unserved areas in the state of Minnesota. Pursuant to the state's broadband goals of a 25 meg download and a 3 meg upload, that definition is now met in all 87 counties and all cities and all townships in the state of Minnesota. So this simple bill just deletes what is really a technically obscure reference, because all areas of Minnesota are either served or now underserved by definition. That's what the bill does. I'm happy to I have no invited testifiers. I suspect there may be one or two people who want to testify on this. But that's the synopsis of my bill.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo. It is a public hearing. Would any members of the public like to testify on the bill? Thank you.
All right.
Please state your name for the record.
Well, Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. I'm Margaret Anderson Kelleher. By appointment of Governor Dayton, I lead the Governor's Broadband Task Force and have for 7 years. I am super excited to be here for the record today. It was exactly what I was planning on doing. And I would like to give you a little public testimony on this bill, and we have great respect for the chairman, but the task force would disagree heartily with this small change in the law. So the task force, the governor's task force, represents a broad range of interests, including business, internet providers, community interests, as well as librarians, education, healthcare, tribal interests as well. And so the legislature over the past number of years has collectively decided that the state can play a very important role in connecting unserved Minnesotans with wireline broadband through both the establishment of the Office of Broadband Development, Indeed, and the Border-to-Border Broadband Program. The legislature together has also repeatedly decided that funding for that program is important, and the use of state dollars would continue to make progress on these goals. These priorities, as well as updating the state's broadband speed goals over the last number of years, and recommendations from the governor have been successful in helping on these tasks. We recognize there is a demand for the use of broadband, and it continues to grow in the state of Minnesota, and technologies do continue to evolve, which I think is what the chairman is getting to in this bill. We also recognize the state grant program is a great example of public and private partnership together, working together to successfully expand broadband in the state of Minnesota into areas of the most need, which tend to be the most rural at this point. Since 2014, the grant program has received $85 million in state funding, which has leveraged over $110 million in private funding, largely private. There's just a small amount of other public funding in that. The program has made service available to almost 35,000 Minnesota households and over 5,000 businesses and 300 community institutions. Now, 88% of all Minnesotans have access to a wireline connection at 25 and 3. That is the definition of high-speed broadband. And nearly almost about 74%, 73.5% of rural Minnesotans have that. But that means there's work left to do. There are currently 252,000 households in Minnesota that don't have that connection today. And it is at that 25 and 3 that is our goal. Removing unserved from the statute places more hurdles in front of those households to be able to get to that connection. That is difficulty for accessing telemedicine, doing kids' homework, as well as the critical business connection that a lot of people need through the wireline connection. We know that new technology is advancing all the time. We recognize that. We believe that one day there will be other, more integrative solutions that get there, but that one day may be too long for that student out in rural Minnesota. We know the grant program has been successful in the past and will continue to be successful with the legislature's support and will of funding it. Changes to the program definitions undermine its intent and threaten to dilute that program, because then anyone could be applying and creating different types of unlevel playing field out there for communities. Right now, communities and providers support the program, and we hope that if the goal is still to achieve those broadband goals of all Minnesotans, and especially the unserved Minnesotans being connected, that we stick with the current language in the program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Glad it is.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Would anyone else wish to testify on the bill? Okay, are there member questions? Actually, we'll start with Representative Baker.
Gosh, thank you very much. Representative Garofalo.
Before you start, Representative Baker, I don't want to get through other testifiers before you make a decision.
I think she asked, right, Madam Chair?
I think that's up to me.
That's impressive.
Oh, boy, that didn't take off.
Please direct your questions to the chair.
Boy, the room turned in a hurry, isn't it? Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate the work of the author and always bringing new ideas on the broadband issue that I find so near and dear. I know that satellite coverage is an option. I still have heard very little support of this kind of technology in my area, just because of the data caps, because of the pricing is not the kind of service that I would consider right now being as accessible, as legitimate, as what the Office of Broadband has been trying to do for many years. I have really enjoyed working with the Office of Broadband, with Commissioner McKenzie, and with the Governor's Task Force. It, I think, especially for me, after dealing with some really rough and tumble agencies in the state with some titling and licensing issues, this is an operation that's working well with competitive grants. I really don't know why we would want to gut the program. I think that serving our unserved folks is the number one reason why this program exists. So we've got to reach these other 252,000 residents that don't have the service that we've promised them, and it's going to take time. I've been pushing Chair Anderson's movement to recognize wireless more, because wireless has gotten so much better. But I will tell you, when I heard Representative McGinnis's bill today about the solar on the schools, well, let's do a satellite on the schools. There's a reason they're not doing that, is because when you get a couple inches of snow, you're done for a while until you get somebody up there to clean it off. And I think I like the idea of future conversations. I do want to see the state at our minimum goals. This is a program we need to keep with for a while. Again, I just want to make sure that we look at this seriously to say that this is a program that still is not yet ready to retire. I want to get there someday, but this isn't the approach, and I would not want to support this this bill, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Before we get on to further questions from the committee, I would just ask Representative Chair Garofalo, do you know if there is a definition of the word areas in the bill, unserved areas? I'm wondering if that's defined as county, service area. Do we know how that's defined? Perhaps the testifier.
Madam Chair and members, the unserved definition, and a few years ago there was both an unserved and underserved definition that existed in the state program in the law, and that is defined, the unserved is defined by not having service at 25 and 3. So that's a 25 megabit upload speed and a 3 download speed. So that is also what happened a few years ago, Madam Chair, is that we adopted the FCC definition of high-speed broadband, and that is defined at 25 and 3.
And do you know how what the geographic area is defined as? Are we talking counties? Do you know what that is in reference to? Is that defined in statute?
So, Madam Chair, it can go as small as we can go as small as census block or township now in terms of what is considered unserved. Minnesota has the premier program for how we measure this. I did get to speak with the chairman of the FCC. Some of you will love that I just said that. Some of you might shudder that I said that in February. And he told me that Minnesota has the premier program in the country for measuring broadband, because the federal way broadband is measured, if one person has broadband at that speed in a county, they would consider the entire county covered. We don't do that in Minnesota. We are able to get much more surgical about measuring this. And in fact, I did want to point out that our 2017 broadband report, which is downloadable on DEED's website, you can go in and play with the maps at the township level, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. I would just make a comment quickly, Chair Garofalo, that if this does include census blocks, certainly there are still areas of Minnesota, in particular my census block, that is still unserved by the 25 and 3 standard. So,
and Madam Chair, how would you make that statement?
I've tried multiple forms of internet that are currently available, and what is available to my home still does not meet those standards.
And Madam Chair, as I've privately advised you before, may I suggest that you attempt to subscribe to the HughesNet service or the new Viasat. Viasat has a new 100 meg download service. You'll find that service is available to you if you choose to. Again, there are everyday wireless technology continues to get better. In fact, as part of the broadband grant program, we actually do incentivize and provide grants for middle infrastructure, middle mile infrastructure, to allow for wireless communication standpoints.
Yes, and that's currently what I use is fixed wireless. And depending on the time of day, the problem with all of these services is that the slowdown speeds are significant. The slowdowns are significant. So at some time of the day, I almost approach the standard, but other times I don't. Okay, sorry. Representative Mahoney, to your question.
I really don't have a question because I don't doubt Ms. Kelleher's assertion that there's 200,000 households that are still not served by 25 and 3. I actually wanted to, I saw this bill and kind of wanted to thank the chair for this particular bill because it made it so simple. All they had to do is go back to last year's Jobs and Economic Development, Energy, and whatever acronyms we're going under. I just review my comments on the floor to the chair. It's the same kind of push that you did last year, and my comments last year were that it's slower, it's not reliable, trees, snowstorms, windstorms can disrupt this. It is not secure, so if you are working from home with a satellite connection, you can't work for almost each and every one of the Fortune 500 companies in the state. Can't work for banks. I haven't been able to find this out for sure since then, but I don't think you can use it to work for the state because it's not secure. I know in a number of different agencies you can't. Let's see. What else did I come up with last year? This recycling bill. So, Mr. Chair, I think this bill is probably before its time. As people have mentioned, we're going to see an explosion in innovation in this world. We are now, and we're going to see it in the continued future. And maybe 5 years from now, the security on it would be fine. Maybe 5 years from now, the disruptions of a tree or a storm would be overcome. And the extra charges for data downloads and uploads would not be there. In the research I did last year, so I haven't done this, found out the charges this year, but it can range anywhere from $100 to $400 or $500 a month. An excess cost and data charges from their typical packages. Now that was last year, maybe they've improved this year. But they've also given me the opportunity to call for a roll call that I haven't yet to see if the chair's bill could go actually down. Because there's so many people in greater Minnesota that this would truly hurt. It is just, you give me so many opportunities, Mr. Chair, and you make it so easy. And the other option was to see this get to the floor and get more widespread to understand how reluctant you are for these 200,000 homes to get a solid connection to broadband and be able to shop on Amazon or stream movies or maybe watch the Vikings with a new quarterback. You know, it could be any number of things. Mr. Chair, I hope we can lose this bill between now and the floor of the House. Just somehow or another, because it's not ready yet. It really, really isn't. I could have more fun with you. I won't. I'm just going to say that this bill needs to be watched for another 4 or 5 years until the technology catches up with the weaknesses in satellite technology.
Chair Grafton.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, a couple corrections. First of all, in the process, we're laying the bill over for possible inclusion, so no, you're not going to defeat the Chair's bill today, so don't worry about that. Second of all, you laid out some excess costs or what the items are. That pricing structure you're mentioning is not in alignment with where the marketplace is today. Minimal amount of research, you can find out that costs are substantially lower than that, whether it's the fixed wireless that we're seeing deployed on an increasing basis or satellite. Now, that pricing structure is just, that's not the case. Third of all, you mentioned the issue of security. And you should know that when people are connecting to their remote offices, the medium they're using is irrelevant. This is why people are able to go to a public Wi-Fi spot at a Starbucks and VPN into their office. VPN is a virtual private network, so the security is contained outside of the signal that it's connecting to. Everything inside that tunnel is secure. So that's why if you're at a coffee shop, you're on a wireless connection, you're on a fixed connection, it really doesn't matter. It's also the reason why when you get your credit card authorized at a gas station, when everyone goes to the gas station to fill up, well, I don't go to the gas station to fill up, but when you all go to the gas station to fill up, most of the time those transactions are transmitted via satellite at a gas station. So those are some of the inaccuracies that I would point out in your statement. But that being said, I think it's pretty clear where the technology is moving from, and the alternative that you're advocating for is one of fiber deployments to low-density deployments. And we can go through and look at the grants that have been offered so far through this program. We can look at the number of households and businesses that have been installed, and that gives you a pretty accurate number of what the per-cost subsidy it is for each residence and for each business. And when I look at that, and I look at where the technology, where it was 3 years ago compared to now, and it's basically the same stuff I've been saying since back in 2015, is that we are continuing to force taxpayer dollars into a program that is really, through the view of hindsight in the future, is going to look pretty silly. And that's just my opinion, and I'm sticking to it.
That's it. Do you want to follow up? Or no?
You can bolt if you want.
I always love when people take my rope. I'm just going to keep quiet.
Representative Howe.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just going to say I think most of what I want to say has already been covered by the Chair and others. But I will say when you talk about census tracts, I don't think that, and I'm not quite sure what the definition of a census tract is, but it leaves those of us out in like my situation that has three households that can't get served. I mean, and I'm getting served by a wireless technology off of a silo a mile and a quarter away, and I just pray that nobody unplugs the wrong thing in the barn because then I go down. But that's even when it's not unplugged, I'm down. When it's working properly and nobody else is on it, I get 2 meg. So.
Mr. Chair, I want to be very clear. We're actually measuring by township in rural Minnesota, which is the smallest unit anyone is measuring by in the country right now. And Representative Howe, I know what you mean. My 94-year-old mother was just talking to Director McKenzie about why she can't get broadband down in the Minnesota Valley, because she actually doesn't have any other silos she can even see on her farm. So, yes, she probably could get a satellite, but at 94, her usage isn't quite the level that she thinks that is going to work at. So I want to just tell you all about the reason to not remove these words from the bill is actually because, in essence, you gut the entire broadband program and dilute it in a way that would not, I think, get to the actual goal of connecting Minnesotans. So I don't want to, the satellite issue is, to me, not the issue today. It's really about getting to those unserved Minnesotans. And in theory, they could subscribe. That's, I think, the theory that the Chair is working under. They could subscribe to a satellite provider. What I think we know today is that in terms of reliability of connection, the wireline connection is still very important for certain types of activities and businesses, and it also is the backbone to your fixed wireless connection and how that gets provided out there. Now we're going to nerd out even further. So
I'm nerd out.
Representative Howe? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Representative Mahoney made reference to Amazon. Please don't shop on Amazon. Support your small town businesses. That's okay. Okay?
the storefront. So anyway, Ms. Keller, I want to go back to some of the things that you said about since the grant program was started, mm-hmm. Which was, how many years, what year was it first started?
Ms. Keller.
Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, I believe the program is its fifth year now.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelleher, you said that 35,000 homes or businesses have been served since then. Mm. And you also said that that was an $85 million expenditure by the state plus about $110 million in private funds, which comes out to $195 million for 35,000 connections, which comes out in my math. I'm a fire teacher, but I do have a calculator. Just about $5,600 per connection. My number's fairly close.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, actually, I'll reference this on page 18 of this year's report. We have the average cost of connection at $5,527. So you are really close. And just to say this one more time again, it's about 35,000 households, over 5,000 businesses, and 300 community locations, which include things like schools.
Representative Fabian.
Like, okay. So then my point is we talked about 252,000 that are unserved, roughly speaking. And if we use that same number, that comes out to about $1.4 billion to finish these connections. And that's a lot of money. And I don't necessarily disagree with the chair. I do think that there's a lot of stuff coming down the pike in terms of technology and better stuff. And I've mentioned this in committee before. I don't know how much time you folks have spent in eastern Kitson County on a ranch. But my point that I'm getting through here with you, Ms. Kelleher, is when I talked to the ranchers and the farmers in eastern Kitson County, and we talked about wireless connections and so forth, this is more important to them than fiber in their home because they're away from home most of the day tending their cattle, their crops, and so forth and so on. Are there any provisions in the grant program for doing more for wireless?
Ms. Miller, so Madam Chair and Representative Fabian, I will answer that in a second. I want to just point out that your math is really good, but the part that is missing in the math of what it would cost the state of Minnesota is it would be about $1.3 billion, but it's 50% of that, and then we also calculate in other programs that are coming in to serve the same unserved people. So there are two federal programs that come in, the Connect America Fund, as well as ACAM funding, that's for smaller providers. When you back that all out, we come up with a $71 million recommendation over the next 4 years to be able to connect all Minnesotans. So I want to be really clear, because one of the things legislators kept asking us is, what is it going to cost to connect the rest of Minnesota? That is our best estimate of connecting all of Minnesota. To your point about wireless, it's very important, and I hear you on this, but to have that wireless connection be reliable, you actually need this backhaul out there as well. So there, you know, could there be a place in the state that doesn't get totally connected? But to have a really good connection, to have that cellular tower, you need the backhaul under the ground to the cellular tower to be able to provide it. So to increase, to make sure that your constituents, those ranchers, are not getting those dropped calls, you need to have that. I just visited with a company yesterday that's also creating agricultural closed systems, multi-tech, in Moundsview. And that's another technology that's coming, and it's really exciting. It uses the cellular backbone. But again, that backbone is built on something.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate your answers. I do. And I know that this is an ongoing conversation. Mr. Schoberg was in my office this morning. I know you're familiar with him. So.
I'm a member of the task force, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lehman.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to just thank Chair Garofalo for bringing this up and having this great conversation before I bring my bill forward, because you've made my path much easier. I hope. As you probably know, I'm authoring a bill to fund this program. And I'm wondering, Chair Keller, do you know how many members there are in the Minnesota Rural Broadband Coalition? You talked about your task force, but there's also something called the Rural Broadband Coalition. How many organizations are part of that?
Madam Chair and Representative Lehman, I think it's over 70 members of the Rural Broadband Coalition, and I am here today on behalf of the task force, but I believe that I'm authorized to speak pretty broadly for both industry and the community advocates who are not supporting this sort of move.
Representative Lehman, thank you. And then, Chair Garofalo, you talked about the bill being simple and eliminating the unserved areas, but aren't you also making one other small change under line 3.13 and eliminating the word wireline?
Chair Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Lehman, that is correct. I was summarizing my comments about the bill and laying out the description of it.
Representative Lehman. And what would the effect be of eliminating wireline?
Chair Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Lehman, I'm not really sure it would have much effect because we already fund both wired and wireless projects. As former Speaker Kelleher mentioned, the focus on last mile infrastructure, that's not always what's being funded in part of these grant programs. It's also the middle mile infrastructure that connects tower to tower. So in my drafting of the bill, when I read this, I'm not really sure that it would make much of a difference, but I could be mistaken on it.
Representative Lehman. I think it probably does make a big change in the definition of what we fund and the importance of having wire connections. Thank you.
Chair Garofalo.
I'll just say, Madam Chair, Representative Lehman, right now some of the grants that are being funded are not last mile infrastructure. They are wireless connections. So.
Representative Lehman. Yeah, I do understand that wireless are eligible completely. If they can meet the speeds, I believe that wireless providers are eligible under the program. Correct.
Chair Garofalo. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, no, I forgot what I was going to say.
Take your time.
I'm
better for your voice.
Yeah. Gosh, it was such a good question, too. But I guess kind of me going in the back way then. Now I know. We have the definition of unserved is 3 up, 25 down. Is that correct? That's unserved?
25 down, 3 up.
Oh, details. But anyway. So what is the definition of underserved then?
So, Madam Chair, I believe that we, the underserved is pegged to the sort of what we would say is the 100 by 20. So that would be 100 download by 20 megabits up. So that's underserved. But, Madam Chair, I want to be clear that because the priority in the broadband funding program goes towards unserved, most of the grants have been to unserved populations because we still have unserved populations in the state. If we had everyone covered at 25 and 3, then communities that were below this 100 by 20 would be eligible and possibly be competitive. But today, what's happening is because we still have those 252,000 households out there that aren't connected at 25 and 3, they are the unserved and they get priority. Their communities get priority.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, you kind of answered this with your goal for statewide deployment. But I have to ask, are there some areas of the state because of just a lack of population, lack of density, where it just doesn't make sense or cost? cost effectiveness to go this entire fiber optic route to the door. Do you recognize that, or is the goal absolutely perfectly 100% over the whole state?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, this is one of the reasons that wireless is eligible to participate, because this technology around fixed wireless has gotten so much better in the last 5 years that the speeds, they can actually now meet the state speed goal, and that's kind of the gateway for the program. And so not everyone is probably going to be connected with that wireline connection, but a big portion of them are. I think the difference here is by removing unserved, you really dilute those. I mean, if you have limited dollars, which I know you are all familiar with around here, then you've got to make some choices about how to deploy those limited dollars, and that's what the program does today with the unserved.
Okay. Representative Anderson, are there any further member questions? Any last comments, Chair Garofalo?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, former Speaker Anderson Kelleher. Always a pleasure. Yes, always a pleasure. Members, I would just point out to you that we live in a world of finite resources. And think about this. Last session, we committed $20 million to broadband, to expand broadband to people, high-speed broadband to people that don't have access to it. If instead today, this year, we put $20 million into broadband, but said, you know what, we're going to pay for vouchers to give people wireless or satellite internet access, and we're going to give them those vouchers for 2 years, you could give the same amount of money and you could serve 20,000 households with high-speed internet today based on the technology that exists today. So it doesn't make sense to be doing, in the vast majority of situations, it just doesn't make sense for the state to continue doing what it's done. For hospitals, schools, business development parks, of course, there's those limited applicabilities. But for the same amount of money that we committed last year, you could connect for 2 years people to have 20,000 households hook up, 25 meg, 3 download at least. So that's my position, and I thank members for the committee. And with that, I renew my motion to have House File 3002 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo. The bill is laid over.
You could have our next presentation come forward. The Center for the American Experiment. Members. No. Please take your conversations outside if need be. We're not done yet.
One more chair, Dan. I'd just like to get after my hair.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Chairman. I am John Hinderacher, President of Center of the American Experiment. With me today are John Phelan, who is an economist at Center of the American Experiment, John has degrees from the University of London and the London School of Economics. And Isaac Orr is with us. Isaac is formerly of the Heartland Institute and as of the last 2 weeks is now a policy fellow also at Center of the American Experiment. What we're going to be talking about today is mostly taken from a report that we did at the end of last year called Energy Policy in Minnesota, The High Cost of Failure. I think that's being passed out to you right now. The authors of the report are Steve Haywood and Peter Nelson. Steve is teaching out at Berkeley, and Peter, who many of you know, has been hired away from us to do healthcare regulation by the Trump administration. So I am sort of pinch hitting for them with the help of John and Isaac to talk about some of the findings in the report. And we're also going to add a few items to what's in the report. So with that prelude, Minnesota is one of a number of jurisdictions that have set very ambitious targets for the reduction of carbon dioxide. Minnesota's got a target of CO2 emissions being reduced 15% below 2005 levels by 2015, 30% by 2025, and 80% by 2050. Those are simply goals or targets, not mandates. But in addition to that, Minnesota has the renewable energy standard of 25 to 30% of electricity from renewable sources. Minnesota is probably one of the poorer places in the world for solar energy for obvious reasons. And as a result of that, Minnesota's green energy strategy has focused overwhelmingly on wind energy. So when we talk about renewable energy in Minnesota as a matter of state policy, fundamentally what we're talking about is wind. And I think by way of context for the things that the state has done in recent years with respect to power generation in particular, it's very important to start with the acknowledgement that demand for energy in Minnesota has been flat. To the extent that money has been spent, and a lot of money has been spent, on wind turbines, for example, it's not to meet new demand. We have enough dispatchable, as they say in the business, sources of electricity to meet the demand here in Minnesota in the form of nuclear, coal, and natural gas power plants. So what's been spent on wind energy really has been an add-on to the already adequate power plants that we've had in this state. And Xcel Energy predicts that our consumption of electricity is going to continue to be flat, at least for the next 15 years. So until we did this report late last year, I don't think anybody had ever tried to add up the dollars that had been spent to provide wind energy to Minnesotans. We've done that, and the numbers are frankly, I think, rather astonishing. What we have found is that about $10.6 billion has been spent to construct wind turbine farms to serve Minnesota consumers. And in addition to that, transmission lines with an estimated cost of about $4 billion have been built. So just about $15 billion has been spent to provide wind energy to Minnesota. And that's reflected in this chart, which shows the sources of energy generation in 1990 and in 2016. And the results are fairly obvious. If you look at 1990, coal was overwhelmingly the source of electricity in Minnesota, followed by nuclear energy, with everything else being very minor. By 2016, the mix of electricity had changed. Coal is still the number one source providing electricity in Minnesota, but significantly reduced compared to 1990. Nuclear is still the second most prominent source of electricity in Minnesota, but it too is reduced since 1990. And you can see that the two principal new sources responsible for generation of electricity are wind and natural gas. There have been conversions of a number of coal plants to natural gas in recent years, as well as we've seen, about $15 billion being spent to provide wind turbines and transmission lines for wind energy. The result of that expenditure has been noticeable to Minnesotans in their pocketbooks. As far back as records have been maintained, Minnesota has benefited from relatively cheap electricity. We have a number of competitive disadvantages in this state. We have to pay to heat our homes in the winter and cool our homes in the summer. But historically, one advantage that Minnesota has had is that our electricity has been quite cheap compared to the national average. Again, as far back as records go, we have had electricity at about an 18% to 20% discount compared to the average across the country. This just comes from the Federal Energy Information numbers. And what it shows is that in recent years, as we have made these enormous capital investments, principally in wind energy, electricity in Minnesota has gotten more expensive. And you can see how the price of electricity, the average price of electricity in Minnesota has steadily risen toward the national average. And 2017 was the first year ever recorded in which electricity in Minnesota was more expensive than the national average, and it continues to rise with respect to the national average. This chart, I think, helps to explain why that's true. This shows the levelized cost of electricity for various sources of electricity. Isaac Orr, I think you're the one that put this chart together. Do you want to just take a couple of minutes and explain what it shows?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the committee, please state your name for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Hi, my name is Isaac Orr, and I'm policy fellow for the Center of the American Experiment. So this cost, this chart shows the cost of electricity. The levelized cost of electricity is calculated by the Energy Information Administration, and it includes key inputs like the capital cost, fuel cost, fixed and variable operation and maintenance, financing costs, and the utilization rate for each plant. So the Energy Information Administration only makes this calculation for new generating resources, but we already have enough our electricity generation capacity to meet our current demands. So we need to understand what the cost is of the electricity generation sources that we already have, and that's what this chart shows. The chart shows that, on average, conventional coal can produce a megawatt of electricity for about $40 per megawatt hour. Natural gas can do it for about $34.4, nuclear about $30, $29, and the blue chart, the dark blue lines, show that the cost of new generation capacity is substantially more than that. So that's largely because if you want to think of these as a house, the financing or the principal has already been paid off to a large degree on a lot of these plants, so they're able to have a much lower operating cost when it comes to capital repayments, mortgages, if you will. So that's why it makes more sense to utilize older power plants that have already paid off their capital costs.
And just if we want to ask a question, we won't take questions until you're done, but I'll ask one.
Yep.
The second from the bottom, it says wind included cost imposed on CC gas. Can you just elaborate on what that means?
Yeah, so obviously everyone knows that wind is intermittent. So building 1 megawatt of wind does not mean you get to retire 1 megawatt of combined cycle natural gas or coal. So therefore you have to impose a certain cost on the coal plant because they can't say, all right, everybody, go home. We don't need you to work today because the wind is blowing. If the wind dies down, they need to be able to come online. So they still have to pay for their staff, their capital costs, their operating costs. And that often, almost always, outweighs the fuel cost that they are avoiding when the wind is blowing. So they're asked to, I don't know, they have to have a higher cost in order to make that up later. And that's why that cost is attributed to wind and solar.
Please proceed.
So if you ask why has $15 billion been spent approximately to supply Minnesota with wind energy, why would we do that since it's so much more expensive than the forms of energy we already have? There's only one answer. The answer is we're trying to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide. This goes back to the targets and mandates that we looked at, I think, in the very first slide. And remember that the goal in this state is to reduce overall carbon dioxide emissions from all sources in Minnesota by 80% by the year 2050, which is now not all that far off. What this chart shows, and again this is just from the Federal Energy Information numbers, shows the estimated total emissions of carbon dioxide from Minnesota between 1990 and 2015. And what it shows is that notwithstanding the billions of dollars that have been expended, that have been invested in wind energy and wind transmission lines, there has not been any significant reduction in Minnesota's CO2 emissions. I think it is perfectly clear that Minnesota is not going to reduce its CO2 emissions by 80% between now and 2050. If you imagine what that line on the chart would have to look like, it simply is not going to happen. And the key to this chart shows you the different sectors that emit carbon dioxide and the amounts being emitted year by year by those sectors. The blue area at the bottom is electric power generation, which is mostly what the state of Minnesota's strategy has been directed to, electric power generation. And then above that, we've got transportation. That's mostly vehicles, obviously. Above that, industrial, and above that, commercial, and then residential at the top. And one of the things that this chart shows us is that even with respect to the electric power generation industry, which has been really the sole focus almost of Minnesota's green energy or renewable energy strategy, there has been very little reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. This chart shows us the same thing, but focusing specifically on CO2 emissions from the electric power generation industry. And what it shows, that sort of green line that goes across the top, shows estimated CO2 emissions between, is that 1990 again, and 2015. And you can see that there has been a little bit of reduction. Carbon dioxide emissions today are about what they were in the early 1990s, but they are a little below the peak in 2005. The state has done a couple of things. We focused on wind energy, which is where by far the largest amount of money has been spent, about $15 billion. But in addition to that investment, the state has also spent money, or utilities have spent money, to convert some coal plants to natural gas. And so the blue lines that you see here show the increasing wind capacity, and the greenish background that you see that's solid shows the increasing use of natural gas. And I should note that the 2 years when you see the drop in carbon dioxide emissions followed by the increase in 2014, those years I believe are 2012 and 2013, that drop wasn't caused by anything that was done in terms of policy, like building more wind turbines. That decline was caused by the fact that the Sherco 3 unit was down for 2 years, and that reduced the amount of carbon dioxide emission in Minnesota and replaced it with electricity that we brought in from somewhere else so that the emission was there, it just was in a different state. So that two-year drop really is an anomaly that doesn't have much to do with the overall policies that we are talking about here. So what we see is that a lot of money has been spent to achieve very little reduction in carbon dioxide emissions. What this chart does is to compare Minnesota to the United States as a whole in two respects. The blue and reddish bars that you see, the tall blue bars and the shorter red bars, those show wind generating capacity in Minnesota versus the United States as a whole. Wind as a percent of total generation. It's on a percentage basis. And as you can see there, Minnesota is one of the states that have committed the most resources and the most policy focus to wind energy. We have much, much, much more wind energy here in Minnesota than the average state does, several times as much. But the two lines that then go from left to right show how Minnesota has reduced CO2 emissions compared to the rest of the United States. So we start in the year 2005, which is the peak year, both for Minnesota and for the country as a whole, and we index that as 100, and then we measure CO2 emissions in the years that have gone by since 1990 up through 2015, which is the most recent year for which there are data. And what that shows is that Minnesota has had almost exactly the same success in reducing carbon dioxide emissions as the average American state. We're just about exactly average compared to what the United States as a whole has done. Again, you see that temporary dip there in 2012 and 2013 when Sherco 3 was down. But we have achieved only average results in CO2 reduction, even though we have made a vastly greater investment in wind energy than the country as a whole. Why is that? Well, the fundamental problem with wind energy is the same as the fundamental problem with solar energy, and that is it is unreliable. And it is unreliable because it is intermittent. You can only make electricity from a wind turbine when the wind is blowing and also when it's not blowing too fast. If the wind isn't blowing, you don't get any electricity, don't get any energy. And there is no technological means available to store electricity at scale. So electricity has to be produced at essentially the instant when it is consumed. And so if a wind turbine isn't turning, there isn't any electricity being generated. And as a result, we have to have enough electricity available to meet our peak demand. It's absolutely unacceptable that we flip a light switch on and nothing happens. The room stays dark. Or you're riding in an elevator past the 35th floor of the building and all of a sudden the elevator stops and the elevator gets dark and the stoplights go out and all over town, the offices, lights go off, nothing works, your refrigerator starts to get warm. Well, why did that happen? It happened because the wind stopped blowing in southern Minnesota. So we can't actually rely on wind energy to provide the electricity to meet our peak demand. We have to be able to meet the peak demand at all times with energy that is dispatchable, which basically means reliable. And that means coal, nuclear, natural gas. There are some other costs here that are unique to wind energy that are important, but we don't have enough time to talk about them in detail. I'll just mention, what's profile cost? What's that all about? Another problem with wind energy is that it produces electricity at the time when the electricity is needed the least, not when it's needed the most. So when does the wind blow the strongest in Minnesota on the average in the spring and the fall? But that's when our electricity demand is also the lowest. The wind also blows on the average stronger at night than during the daytime. But during the daytime is when we have our peak electricity demands. So very often, turbines may be turning and they may be producing electricity, but it's electricity that nobody needs and frankly nobody wants because it's at a time when the demand for electricity is lower. And so it's actually not rare for the producers of wind energy to sell at a loss, to actually pay utilities or others to take the wind energy off their hands. They can actually make money doing that because of federal subsidies. The federal subsidies are such that a wind farm can actually pay someone to take the energy that nobody wants and still make a profit. So there are other issues there, too, that we just don't have time to go into. But there are a lot of problems along with intermittency that plague wind energy. One of the points that didn't get made often enough, and I won't make it at length here, is that wind energy is very bad for the environment. You rarely hear people say that, but it's true. It uses a tremendous amount of land. It requires long transmission lines. You can site a conventional power plant near the population center that's going to use most of its electricity. You can't do that with a giant set of wind farms. You put those potentially hundreds of miles from where most of the electricity is going to be consumed. So one, you have to use a lot of land, take it out of agricultural use or some other kind of use. Two, you have to build a long transmission line. Three, you kill enormous numbers of birds and bats. It's a problem that remains unsolved. And four, they're noisy. And five, the aesthetic impact is considered to be very negative by most people, many people anyway, who live in proximity to wind turbine farms. So a strong case can be made that not only is wind energy economically unproductive and disadvantageous, but it's also bad for the environment. Okay, I'm going to stop there because we have done some additional analysis that is not reflected in the paper that you've all got a copy of, and John Phelan, our economist, has taken a look at what are some of the economic consequences of the higher cost of electricity that we're all paying as a result of this enormous investment that's been made in wind energy.
My name is John Phelan. I'm an economist at the Center for the American Experiment. The first thing I'd like to talk about is this slide that you can hopefully see up there now. When we talk about the increase in prices that you saw in that chart earlier on, of the erosion of Minnesota's cost advantage in terms of energy prices, that actually is a regressive impact. And what this chart here shows you is the share of income paid for energy by households earning certain amounts in income. So people who earn below $30,000 a year spend 21% of their incomes on their household energy costs. People earning between $30,000 and $50,000 a year, they pay 13%. And people earning over $50,000 a year pay an estimated 7% of their household incomes and their energy costs. So you can see that in terms of the impact in terms of social equity and things like that, the burden really is borne disproportionately by the less well off.
Let me just add something, John. There was something I should have said on one of the earlier slides and I forgot to say it. We're talking about a lot of money here. The fact that Minnesota has lost the advantage, the price advantage of electricity that it historically always had, has cost Minnesota consumers so far about $4.4 billion. That's laid out in the report. And currently, Minnesota consumers are paying more than $1 billion a year in increased electricity costs by virtue of the fact that we have lost that cost advantage. So we're talking about a lot of money, and it's money that falls disproportionately on less well-off Minnesotans.
That's absolutely true. In the report, page 7, if you want to skip to it, we estimate what this cost advantage used to be between Minnesota and the U.S. average. In 2007, the difference was 18.5% in Minnesota's favor. By 2016, that was down to 2.5%. As you saw in 2017, it vanished completely. So overall, what would Minnesotans have spent, what would they have saved if they'd maintained that cost advantage of 2007, the 18.5%? We estimate that, as John said, at $1 billion in 2016. Now, one of the things that you often hear said in favor of things like solar and wind is the economic benefits. People talk about the jobs created. That's a very, very popular metric that people use. But what they don't talk about is the jobs that are lost. Because when you divert money like this, you create jobs here, but you lose jobs there. And very often people tend to see the jobs created, because obviously they're created. It's a lot harder to imagine the jobs that never come into being. Famous economist once said it's the difference between what is seen and what is not seen. So what we try to do here is, in our next slide, is we try to quantify the impact of the what is not seen. So for example, there was a recent study by Clean Energy Economy Minnesota, who are an industry-led non-profit, and they estimated that there were about 6,200 jobs in Minnesota in 2016 in renewables. And this is obviously often said as a wonderful thing for the economy. But what we did is we took that $1 billion that Minnesotans paid in 2016 for their energy, above what they would have paid if the state had maintained its cost advantage of 2007, the 18.5%. And we looked at what would have happened if Minnesotans had that income in their pockets to spend rather than shoveling it off to power companies. And what we see here, this was arrived at, by the way, using Implan economic modeling software. It's, bog standard, gold standard, whichever one you want. It's the commonly used method for estimating these things, developed here in Minnesota. And we estimated that if Minnesotan households had this $1 billion to spend in 2016, that would have led to an increase in employment of 8,759 jobs, which you can see just about more than sets off the estimates of Clean Energy Economy Minnesota's employment for renewables in the state. Labor income would have been about $4.9 million higher than it actually was in 2016. If you divide that by the new jobs, you get an income of about $47,000 a year. So not really anything to be sniffed at. And in total output, so this will be the contribution to the state's GDP, we'll be looking at $1.2 billion in 2016. And of course, all this economic activity would generate tax impacts, which I'm sure you'd like to hear about. The taxes on employee compensation, tax on production imports, households, corporations, you can all see there, I shan't run through all of them with you, but you can see they're not inconsiderable sums. So when you think about the taxes paid by energy companies, you have to think as well about the taxes lost by diverting these resources and this money out of the pockets of Minnesotans and transferring over to these companies in the form of higher prices. And this year is, I think, is an interesting little graphic, because one of the things when people talk about the jobs created in these industries, they forget sometimes that the purpose of an energy industry is to generate energy. It's not to generate jobs. If you wanted to generate jobs in energy, it would be very easy. You could hire people to stand in fields and blow at wind turbines. You would have almost no impact on the energy produced, but you would employ an awful lot of people. So what we see here, somebody actually estimated the amount of people it took using each of these methods, coal, natural gas and solar, to produce a given output of energy. And you'll see that the same amount of output that one coal worker produced, or that two natural gas workers produced, it took 79 solar workers to produce. So when you think that the purpose of economics is productivity, it's to generate more output with the same number of inputs, solar really stacks up pretty badly on that measure. And with that, I should like to hand over to my colleague John.
That completes the PowerPoint. I think 4:45 I saw on the paper was supposed to be adjournment time. I don't know how strict that is, Mr. Chairman, but we're certainly happy to take any questions that people have.
Sure, we'll go a little bit past it. I can't imagine anybody in the audience or in the room disagrees with anything that was said, so I doubt there'll be any questions. Just a couple of questions for me before we go to member comments and questions. One of the things that you highlighted is the higher costs that Minnesotans are paying relative to the national average, and I believe the data on that is EIA data, so I don't think there's much of a dispute. Is that correct? Is that what the data is?
Yes.
Okay. The dispute people might have is that it would be unfair to attribute the entire loss of competitiveness in that exclusively to just the two policy decisions, just the policy decision of renewable energy. So how would you respond to that if someone were to say, well, yes, we recognize that we've lost the costs, we've lost that cost advantage, yes, we understand it's costing $1 billion more, but there's other policy considerations besides renewables that would account for that. How would you respond to that?
Well, I agree. Electricity pricing, of course, ultimately governed by the PUC, and there's all kinds of factors that go into it. But there's only one thing that's happened in this last 8 or 10 years that accounts for that sudden change in the trajectory of pricing of electricity, and that is the effort to go to green energy. The $15 billion spent on wind energy dwarfs any similar numbers. So, for example, it's true that we also converted some coal plants to natural gas, but if you go back and look at the costs of those on a project-by-project basis and add it up, you're talking about a very small fraction of the $15 billion that was spent on wind energy. So I would say absolutely there are multiple factors at play, but if you ask yourself what changed in the last 8 or 10 years and all of a sudden changed the historic trajectory, I think it's pretty obvious it was Minnesota's green energy mandates, and then if you ask where did the dollars go, the vast majority of the dollars went into wind energy.
Others may point out this out as well, is that like most of Minnesota's utilities have already met the renewable energy standard, but yet they're still continuing to purchase this energy. So if in fact it's more expensive, why would utilities be why would they be right now voluntarily choosing to purchase these energy sources that you say are more expensive?
Well, they purchase them very cheap, for one thing. You know, wind energy sells in the market very, very cheaply. Somebody paid a lot more money for it in the first instance, but this is the profile cost that we're talking about. It sometimes is literally sold at a loss, below cost. And yet the producer can make money because of the large federal subsidies. So that's a complicated question. That's at least part of the answer.
Questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment to the in this gentleman. Thank you, because it's not every day that I get to hear 19th century French economists quoted in a committee or on the floor, and I do appreciate the Bastiat. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments from the committee? Members, we are at the adjournment time, and I'm trying to decide if we should kind of get additional public testimony now or maybe at a future committee hearing. I'll defer to the judgment of the committee, what people want.
Now, please.
All right, so whoever, Commissioner Grant, I see you're here. If you want to, did you wish to speak? Not at this time? Okay. Annie Levinson-Falk? And Ms. Levinson-Falk, how much time do you think you need to provide an appropriate rebuttal?
I can try to keep it 5 minutes.
5 minutes is cool.
Try. Super.
Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I am the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, which is a nonprofit that advocates for Minnesota's residential and small business utility consumers.
Thank you.
I did prepare a PowerPoint, but I don't have the right port on this laptop, so the page, I think, is handing around the paper versions of it, and I apologize to those in the audience that won't be able to see that.
Do you have a Mac?
I do have a Mac, so I borrowed a PC, but it's updated and it doesn't have the old plug-in. Cub spends a lot of time working both with individual customers to help them figure out how to bring their home energy costs down and also working on energy policy at a much higher level scale. So we've looked into the pressures on people's energy costs. And in addition to that, I formerly worked for Chair Garoppolo here at the Legislative Energy Commission, and in that role did some research on the trends and cost drivers behind the increase in electric rates here in Minnesota, and I've kind of kept that up to date as I've been at CUP, so I'd like to share a little bit of that with you today. As you'll see on the second slide, the average retail price of electricity dollars per kilowatt hour or cents per kilowatt hour has been increasing in Minnesota faster than the national average. And as of 2017, we are about at the national average. I believe we're like 1 cent less than the national average or something like that. But customers don't pay rates, they pay bills. And if you look at the third slide, you'll see that the average monthly residential energy bill, or electricity bill, I should say, in Minnesota has remained significantly below the national average. And that's despite the fact that some parts of our state have a significant electric heating load in the winter and some parts have a significant cooling load in the summer. Despite that, bills have remained quite a bit below the average electricity bill for the U.S. And a big part of that is that we're really good at energy efficiency. Customers do a lot on their own. I can attest to this because it's one of the main things that we talk to Minnesotans about is how can we conserve energy. Both because people don't like to waste and they also don't like to spend more money than they have to. And the utility energy efficiency programs really help that. I think we have some of the best energy efficiency programs in the country run by Minnesota Utilities. So for your average residential customer or a lot of businesses, I think that the total bill is what they're really going to be looking at. That said, rates have been rising faster than the national average in Minnesota, and so we've been looking into what are the factors behind that. One that's frequently cited and was today is the renewable energy standard. And each of the major regulated electric utilities in Minnesota actually has to file regularly with the Public Utilities Commission an analysis of the rate impact of the renewable energy standard for their utility. So that's about every other year, I believe, is what those are updated. And I pulled out the numbers from our three largest utilities, Great River Energy, which supplies the majority of the co-ops in Minnesota, Xcel, and Minnesota Power. And you'll see that they vary slightly. But Great River and Minnesota Power both say that the RES had a negative impact on rates. which means that complying with the Renewable Energy Standard has actually been saving their customers money. Great River reported a cost of negative 0.17 cents, Minnesota Power negative 0.34 cents, so a third of a cent per kilowatt hour. Xcel reported about a quarter of a cent cost. But Xcel is actually the utility that's been most aggressively pursuing renewables above the requirements by law. And their CEO, I mean, Xcel is certainly capable of keeping speaking for themselves, but their CEO presented recently and has said that they are able to purchase new wind power, build their own generation, not purchase it off the market, for less than it costs to simply operate their existing coal plant. So it's a good business decision for them. It's a good decision for their customers to invest more heavily in renewables.
And Ms. Levinson-Falk, would this include the solar energy standard as well or not?
I don't believe that it does. I believe that's reported separately.
I don't think it does either because it's a 2015 report. So
you're right.
Please continue.
You'll see in there just a subset of the levelized cost of energy. I'm not exactly sure where the numbers in the presentation earlier came from. The source I'm citing here is from the Lazard study that is put out every year, updated numbers. Lazard is an international investment banking and asset management firm. I apologize. Do you maybe not have that on your printout?
We do.
Okay.
This is this one right here.
No, there's another slide that you probably don't have. I apologize.
I'll just describe it.
What it shows is that wind is the lowest cost energy, even unsubsidized. So if you take out the effects of the federal production and investment tax credit on bringing down the actual purchase price of wind and solar, even without that, wind is still the least cost energy. And here in the Midwest, it's even cheaper because we're windy. So that explains why our utilities and have been pursuing wind power above what's legally required. Mr. Chair, the slide that you pointed to is, I just took this out of a presentation the utilities 2 years ago presented to the Legislative Energy Commission with what, for each of them, what the major pressures were on rates. Obviously, every utility is different. Everyone is unique, but they do face some common pressures. So I pulled out the example from Minnesota Power because I thought it most directly addressed the question. And you'll see in their ranking of the factors that they believe are impacting or pushing their rates up, along with some relative scale of each. The first, by far, is the cost of fuel and purchased energy. I would note that there is no fuel cost for wind, so the price that the utilities pay from the beginning is the price that it's locked in. Transmission costs, environmental improvement, which is pollution controls on fossil fuel plants. And then renewables are very, all the way down at the bottom with what they have as one star compared to, I think it's 7 or 8 for the top factor. And then finally, the point was made that Minnesota is falling short of our greenhouse gas emissions goals, and therefore renewable energy is not addressing greenhouse gases. It's certainly true that as a state, economy-wide, we're not on track to meet the greenhouse gas emissions goals. The chart that you have there shows the trend in greenhouse gas emissions between 2005 and 2014. For each sector of the economy. The blue bar with the little wind turbine is electricity. Electric sector is actually the only sector that's been on track to meet its share of the goals, whereas some other sectors have actually increased emissions. And what I believe this points to is that if there is a commitment by the state to meeting our greenhouse gas goals, that we should probably think about doing more to electrify other sectors of the economy, including transportation and some other building energy uses like heating and things like that, and continue the trend of decarbonizing the electric sector. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to speak that, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Levinson-Falk, and I want to thank all our testifiers. I think these are two important presentations I would encourage members to hold on to. Obviously, I think there are areas of agreement, there's areas of disagreement, and on those areas where there is agreement in the data, we should all be working together to try to achieve different policy outcomes that benefit Minnesotans. So thank you for your presentation. Thank you to our previous testifiers.